You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of August, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda. Jane Kinnaman from Chatham House will join us in the studio. We'll discuss troubles in Egypt, protests in Bahrain, and Women's Day in Tunisia.
Also on the show, the launch of India's homemade military, the INS Vikrant, has been unveiled. We'll ask what the new aircraft carrier means for India's future and how closely China's been watching.
India has been going through problems in terms of its shipbuilding industry and capabilities. As a result of that, most of the main projects were delayed.
And citizens of Oslo have found their prime minister driving a taxi. We ask our correspondents what the locals in their corner of the world would say if their leader got into a cab.
I guess I'd tell him to try to pursue what he said he was going to pursue. You know, he can keep after it.
And later on, we'll head to Istanbul. When it comes to its history and modernization, it's a city at war with itself.
Design was always important, I think, for Turkey and especially for Istanbul, but we may not have found the right way to show it or to talk about it.
All that, plus we'll review this morning's Turkish front pages, and then we'll also check in with our man in Budapest, and we may even play some music as well. That's all to come in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House.
Let's get started, as ever, with the world news headlines. Barney Burnham is here.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. At least 16 people have been killed and 41 injured in a suicide bomb attack on a crowded cafe in Balad, 80 kilometres north of Baghdad. The local mayor says all the casualties were civilians. Eyewitnesses say the attacker detonated explosives he was wearing as he entered the cafe. US Secretary of State John Kerry says Israel's announcement of new settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem was to some degree expected. But he's urging Israelis and Palestinians to go ahead with peace talks due to resume this week. He was speaking in Colombia, where he began his first official visit to South America.
The United States of America views all of the settlements as illegitimate. That is the policy of the United States. And we have communicated that policy very clearly to our friends in Israel. And we have worked very closely with the Palestinians in order to try to make certain that everybody understands what the road forward will be like. I think what this underscores, actually, is the importance of getting to the table quickly.
Officials in Israel say the military has intercepted a rocket near Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, exploding it in the air over the southern Israeli city of Eilat. No damage or injury was reported in the incident, which was the first time Israel's Iron Dome interceptor had struck a missile fired at Eilat. The military official declined to say exactly from where the missile had been fired. A court in the United States has found a brutal gangster who ruled over Boston's criminal underworld in the 1970s and 80s guilty of murder and racketeering. 83-year-old James Whitey Bulger evaded capture for 16 years. But will now probably spend the rest of his life in prison. He ran the Winter Hill crime gang after coming to power in a mob war that resulted in the deaths of members of rival gangs. The jury found prosecutors had proved their case in 11 murders out of the 19 charged at trial. United States Attorney Carmen Ortiz.
So many people's lives were so terribly harmed by the criminal actions of Bulger and his crew. And today's conviction does not alter that harm, and it doesn't lessen it. However, we hope that they find some degree of comfort in the fact that today has come and Bulger is being held accountable for his horrific crimes.
A U.S. judge has ruled that the New York Police Department's stop-and-frisk crime-fighting tactic was unconstitutional. U.S. District Judge Shira Shindlin called it indirect racial profiling because it targeted racially defined groups, resulting in the disproportionate and discriminatory stopping of tens of thousands of blacks and Hispanics, while the city's highest officials turned a blind eye. As part of her ruling, she ordered the appointment of an independent monitor and other immediate changes to police policies. Her remedies addressed two lawsuits, one brought by the New York Civil Liberties Union, the other by the Center for Constitutional Rights. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg says he'll be appealing against the ruling.
Throughout the case, we didn't believe that we were getting a fair trial. And this decision confirms that suspicion. And we will be presenting evidence of that unfairness to the appeals court. We only go where there is a report of a crime and the people that are there fit the description, or the police officer sees something that looks suspicious.
A man has died after falling around 60 feet from the upper deck of the Atlanta Braves' Turner Field baseball stadium. Braves issued a statement during their game against the Philadelphia Phillies confirming the fall, which resulted in the man being transported to hospital. Local police later confirmed that he had died. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. It is 6 minutes past the hour here in London. Barney will be back at the bottom of the hour with another check of your world headlines. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And welcome back. You are listening to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. It's time now to set the day's agenda with the three news stories you need to know for the next 24 hours. Well, joining us today in the studio is Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow for the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. Jane, welcome to the program. Shall we start, though, in Egypt? Plans by the military and police to break up a Cairo sit-in, thereby pro-Morsi supporters. It hasn't gone ahead, though, has it?
Good morning. No, this has been interesting. The military said that they were going to disperse the protest camp, but they haven't moved yet. And it looks like some of the elements in the government are cautioning them to avoid violence. The Brotherhood supporters in the square have clearly been preparing for violence, surrounding themselves with sandbags, taking up light weapons, sticks and so on. And it seems that there is a pause while the government thinks, hang on, is this the way to handle it? Can we disperse this through dialogue instead?
Is this going to be seen by Brotherhood supporters and others as the government blinking, as them sort of showing some sort of weakness at this point?
It could be. That said, the authorities haven't moved on a lot of the issues that matter to the Brotherhood, including the detention of Mohamed Morsi and other senior leaders. There have been international mediators and some US senators in town recently who, according to various leaks, seem to have been trying to see if they could secure a safe exit for Morsi, even potentially his exile. But so far, neither side seems to be backing down on that.
And much of the attention has really been focused on events in Cairo. But the unrest has really spread far beyond that. And much of that unrest is now being focused in the Sinai Peninsula. There's been a huge increase in attacks. We know that there are reports that the Egyptian military and the Israelis have coordinated on some of those attacks to root out really those Islamists making those attacks. What's the situation there in the Sinai?
It's very messy. The Sinai has been very insecure since the uprising started. Essentially, a lot of the police fled at that time. There's been an increase in militancy. And to some extent, the military have tried to blame the Muslim Brotherhood for that, although it's not very clear that they really have that responsibility. But what we saw very recently for the first time was Israel using drone strikes on militants in the Sinai. That's quite a new development. It raises questions as to whether that's something that could even go further afield and even potentially happen in Syria as well.
You alluded to international presence in Egypt and trying to secure some sort of future for Mohamed Morsi, possibly outside of Egypt, and his exile, potentially. I wonder where the Muslim Brotherhood sits now, sort of in terms of its international, its relationship with these international bodies that are coming in, trying to deal with it. Where's it sitting now?
Well, what's ironic is you're seeing a growing anti-Western sentiment both among the Brotherhood and among the new government in Egypt. You're seeing the US and the EU trying to take a middle ground. So the US, for instance, not wanting to say there's been been a coup in Egypt, but also saying, you know, you should probably treat the Brotherhood more democratically. And it's ending up upsetting both sides. The Brotherhood think they've been betrayed. They think that the West has sold them out. And the long-term implications of that are also quite concerning for the future of that movement.
And Jane, let's stay in the region, but let's move on to Bahrain. It's a country where back in 2011, a quarter of its population protested. They turned out on the streets, which is quite an astounding number. But many saying, you know, the uprising in Bahrain is the forgotten one. Yes. But maybe, you know, they're going to head back to the streets tomorrow, from what we understand.
Yes, there's been an attempt to get a resurgent protest movement going. You've seen protests continuing throughout the 2.5 years, but on a much smaller scale. It's not easy to keep mobilising large numbers. What's happened is that some activists in Bahrain wanted to imitate what happened in Egypt. They said, let's go for this same call, Tamarod rebellion, get people out to the streets. It might not have been a huge thing, but there's been a massive preemptive government crackdown, hundreds of arrests, including of bloggers accused of things like inciting rallies that might end in vandalism and violence. And now the tensions are so high that I imagine there will be large numbers tomorrow, and the risk of clashes being violent is also quite high.
There does seem to be lots of sort of connected issues between Bahrain and Egypt, or at least lots of ways in which Bahrain is following in the footsteps to some degree. What's that connection about?
Well, this is why Egypt is so important, is that every Arab country does get influenced by it and does look towards it. But it's not a simple connection. So on one hand, the opposition will look at Egypt and say, fantastic, they proved that people power still exists. You can get people to the streets. Let's do it again. Meanwhile, the government looks at Egypt and most of the Gulf governments have been very happy to see the military step in and overthrow the Muslim Brotherhood. So they both see the situation in totally different ways.
We talk there about Egypt being important in this relationship, but I think it's important to remember, of course, the American relationship.
Absolutely.
A relationship that we should not overlook. The American Fifth Fleet is stationed in Bahrain. There are some 15,000 American troops in the capital, Manama. You know, during the initial Arab uprising, we heard stories from the Obama administration saying they support people power, they support the people on the streets, democracy, but they let Bahrain go unnoticed.
Pretty much. I mean, in the early days of the uprising, the US was trying to help to negotiate some kind of compromise. But Saudi Arabia made it very clear that it was firmly against a compromise that would involve anything like a properly elected parliament or an elected prime minister. And since then, the US hasn't been terribly active. They're saying they would support reform efforts. They occasionally make criticisms on human rights grounds, but you don't really see effective policies that are dramatically changing the situation.
And do you think there could be a change from the Americans if protests tomorrow get quite violent?
Actually, I think it's unlikely. I think we're seeing a US administration that is very hesitant to get deeply involved in the region. They are extremely hesitant over Syria, which is a much, much worse conflict. They are also, it seems, confused about the direction to take in Egypt. Bahrain might be an easier win because their leverage is greater. But if anything, they're going to keep focusing on the Middle East peace process and generally try and focus on Asia.
Okay, protest story number three then. Let's head to Tunisia. It's National Women's Day today. So we're having women rallying in the capital. How does this plug into the wider political situation in Tunisia?
It's an interesting example of how women's rights become one of the most contentious issues, with both the Islamists and the secularists saying that they have the right idea about how women should fit into society. And the reason they have this day of celebration today is because it's 57 years since Tunisia passed a family law, which was at the time the most progressive family law in the Arab world. Very liberal, allowing women greater rights when it comes to issues like divorce. Tunisia even permitted abortion before Spain did. It's something it's a place that's always been quite liberal when it comes to women. So secular opposition women are marching saying the Islamist government that dominates our National Assembly is against women's rights. They're setting us backwards. Meanwhile, the Islamists are having a rally saying, we are for women being a pillar of the democratic transition and, ironically enough, national unity. it's a time of great tension there as well, again because of Egypt. The secularists look at what happened in Egypt. They've seen a couple of secular opposition leaders assassinated in Tunisia, and they think maybe it's time for us to push back more strongly, and maybe the Islamists are not here to say.
Jane, fascinating set of stories there from the Middle East. The uncertainty in that part of the world definitely does continue. We're going to have to leave it there, though. Jane Kinnamon, Senior Research Fellow for the Middle East and North Africa Program at Chatham House. Many thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. See you soon.
Coming up, we'll find out which country has just got itself a shiny new aircraft carrier.
What can you do in a Moscow traffic jam? Are rich cities boring cities? How do you create a quake-proof capital? Which city has drag stars as taxi drivers? Who lives in the skyscraper squat? How do you build a city from scratch? And who ditched the garbage truck for a pony and cart? Get the answers to the city's biggest questions and challenges every week on The Urbanist, our show about the cities we live in. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, it premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes. Oh, and the answers are knit, yes, ask the Japanese, San Francisco, where else, the Caracas poor on the up, and a greener than thou Malmo hood. Urbanist listeners, don't look too smug. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
Surf's up this summer as Monocle Films follows the wind in search of an under-the-radar beach haven for diehard enthusiasts.
Ericeira is special for its wide array of waves, beach breaks, point breaks, and reef breaks to suit a range of surfing styles and skill levels, all in a compact span of dramatic coastline. This 8-kilometer stretch of coast was named a World Surfing Reserve in 2011, and the surfers who come here can't stop raving about it.
Catch the wave in Ericeira, in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, India has just joined the US, Russia, France and the UK in a rather exclusive global club. It's the fifth nation to start to develop its own aircraft carriers. The INS Vikrant is indeed the first of its kind, built by the state-owned Cochin shipyard in the south of the country.
The Vikrant will carry Russian-made MiG-29 jets and will join a UK-built carrier already in the Indian fleet. But the key nation in the story of the Vikrant is, of course, China. The ship was commissioned in response to the Asia-wide arms race triggered by increased Chinese military spending. Well, a bit earlier, we heard from Dr. Alessio Padolano, an Asian naval defense expert from the War Studies Department at King's College London. Here's what he had to say.
This is likely to be used as a replacement, well, initially as a training platform, but then in the medium-long term to replace the current carrier that India has in its pendant list. So primarily it will be replacing an existing component of what is primarily an ASW-4. So it's a force designed to conduct anti-submarine operations and limited air operations in the Indian Ocean.
Is this a serious development or is it just symbolic?
It is a serious development, and it's been in the pipes for quite some time. So in this respect, one of the key questions about India is not whether India is serious or not about its navy. It has been a serious player in the region, in the Indian Ocean region, for quite some time. The question is the timing. India had, over the time, has been going through problems in terms of its shipbuilding industry and capabilities. And as a result of that, most of the main projects were delayed, and the carrier was delayed too. Now, the interesting thing about this one, this is the first indigenously built carrier. So in this respect, it is very interesting to see how far it will go, how long it will take to be completed and to become fully operational, as a way to understand how far Indian shipbuilding industry is developing.
And Alessio, just a quick question about the Indian Navy in general. What's the state of the Indian Navy?
Interesting question. The Indian Navy obviously draws its origin from the Royal Navy. It inherited sort of like the basic training, the basic ethos, and also for a number of years they were deploying former Royal Navy assets, which speaks a lot, speaks volumes about the fundamental sort of natural professionalism, naval professionalism in India. However, as I said, over the years, over the past few decades, one of the fundamental problems in India, has been the domestic productions of vessels, which is at the heart of the effectiveness and the sort of performance of the service altogether. So that said, the Indian Navy has been particularly active, both in terms of all the important components of naval power, diplomatic functions by going around visiting ports, being used as a tool for the pursuit of diplomatic agenda, and also it's increasing its size with a key players, including Japan, for example, showing an intent, a willingness to be considered as a major player in the Indian Ocean and possibly the Pacific region.
That's Dr. Alessio Patalano, Asian naval war expert at the War Studies Department of King's College here in London. Rahul Bedi joins us on the line now from New Delhi. He's a regular contributor for us from that city. Rahul, I looked at a headline in The Hindu which said, India joins big league with launch of indigenous aircraft carrier. Clearly a source of great national pride. But then commentators at CCTV, the Chinese state television station, saying it's not really indigenous because all of its parts aren't actually Indian. Are they trying to rain on the parade a little bit?
Well, the indigenous content of it, according to the Navy, is about 60%, which means that about 40% of its particularly its fighters and its weaponry is imported. But the Chinese would react in this way because this is likely to step up the competition between the Indian and the Chinese navies. The Indian Navy has a lot of carrier experience. It's been operating carriers since, in fact, the mid-60s, whereas the Chinese Navy has only just operationalized its first carrier about a year ago.
And, Rahul, this isn't the only first. The Vikrant is not the only first for the Indian Navy at this time. Just 2 days ago, India activated the nuclear reactor on board its first ever built nuclear submarine, the INS Arihant. What's behind this sudden push for all these firsts for the Indian military?
Well, all these programs have a long lead time, so they've been in the pipeline for many, many years. In fact, the aircraft carrier has been in the pipeline for about 10 or 15 years. It's about 4 or 5 years delayed. The nuclear submarine that you mentioned, whose reactor has been activated, has been in the pipeline for over 25 years. But the onus on developing these weapon systems is partly stems from India's desire at power projection, because as India becomes an economic power, it feels that it must expand its muscles a bit. And secondly, the Indian Navy wants to become a big player in the Indian Ocean region. I mean, it's a big boast that in the Indian Ocean is the only ocean that is named after a country. So the Indian Navy wants to capitalize on that monopoly.
Rahul Bedi, we will have to leave it there, I'm afraid, joining us from New Delhi on India's new naval developments.
No, that was not Dominic Reynolds' fans outside Studio One screaming at his arrival.
Brilliant.
That was the moment there that some unsuspecting taxi passengers in Oslo realized that their driver was none other than the Norwegian Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg. Well, the Prime Minister got behind the wheel of a local cab for a couple of hours last week to hear what people really think.
The conversations were all recorded, as we were hearing there, to be used as part of Stoltenberg's re-election campaign later this year. Now, as populist stunts go, it's undeniably amusing, but it does overturn the traditional dynamic of that sort of interaction, i.e. the one in which the trapped passenger is subjected to the taxi driver's opinions about how the country should be run, usually involving a rigorous program of hanging, flogging and sending back.
Well, in order to restore some balance, we asked our correspondents around the world to ask local cab drivers the one thing they'd ask their leaders. In a moment, we'll hear from New York City and Madrid, but first, our Jerusalem correspondent, Joseph Dana, took a cab on our behalf in Ramallah.
مرحبا. If you had President Abbas in your taxi today, what would you ask him?
First, I ask him, where are you going? Yeah, I ask him, for where, please, that's all.
Would you ask him any questions about the political situation in Palestine now?
No, we are not speak about this. We speak about, if he ask me, I answer him. If he didn't ask, no, because I am a driver.
So if Abbas was sitting in the front seat here and he said, you know, I'm going back to negotiations with Israel, what do you think? You think that's a good idea? What would you say?
I think that about the peace is dead. We not believe anybody. The people here want peace. But where is the peace? 24 years we are waiting for nothing come. The situation very, very bad here.
So when you're driving around Ramallah as a taxi driver, yeah, what do a lot of your customers say when they get in the cab? What are people talking about here?
Nearly nobody speaks about the peace or the telecommunication between Israel and Palestine. No. Nobody. Everybody here speaks about the situation. Akalkali. What's the word? Mazomir Akalkali.
The economy.
The economy. It's just about this. It is difficult, no works, no money. About this they are work speaks.
Vamos a Malasaña, por cierto.
Sí, sí, me puedes llevar a calle San Bernardo, la esquina de calle San Bernardo y calle Palma.
Sobre todo se está hablando de que.
Mainly, what people are talking about are the millions of euros spread across so many accounts, so many millions stashed away in tax havens, and how a single person can't be the only one involved. It's impossible to believe that one person is behind it all. That one person was able to siphon off so many millions into so many accounts, accounts belonging to a political party, and then amass such a fortune. One person isn't able to do all that alone. That's something that is talked about here a lot, and that's why we just don't believe what they're telling us. In fact, recent polls show that 72% of the population don't believe them. As for Rajoy, in the debate that was heard only 10 or 12 days ago in Parliament, no one believes what he said. Did you hear about that?
What about in your taxi? Are the people? Does anyone believe Rajoy that comes into your taxi?
I have not met anyone who defends Rajoy. I haven't met anyone at all. And I repeat, from the outside, Rajoy might come across as a serious man, straight and narrow, with very clear ideas. But here, we see him, as we say here in Spain, as someone who has been all too ready to pull down his pants to Brussels. And that has not been good for society. He should not have done many of the things that he has done.
You're obviously talking about politics all day long. Do you ever get bored about talking kind of politics when things are so bad and things are so negative?
Correcto.
You're right. It's a good question. And I'll be very clear and concise. It's true that I talk a lot about politics with people, and one tries to be unbiased with customers because you should always show some restraint and respect. But yes, it's true that with each passing day, I like to talk less about politics.
Hi. So the president of Norway was in taxi cabs with people, and they were sort of unloading on him. But it sort of begs an interesting question. If Barack Obama got into a taxi cab here, and you had a chance to talk to him, what would you say to him?
Well, first of all, I'd tell him I thought he was great, because I do. And I guess I'd tell him to try to pursue what he said he was going to pursue. I realize that, you know, there's three branches of government and he doesn't control two of them, but he does have the bully pulpit, so, you know, he can keep after it.
you don't have to answer this, but did you vote for him?
Yeah, I did.
And why did you vote for him? What did he mean to you? What was the importance of it?
I thought he was pretty real, and I thought that it was important that he was African-American and that the African-Americans need to be perceived as part of our society. I mean, part of our equal society and effective.
You know, just in general, people get into this cabin, you probably hear a lot of funny conversations. You probably have a lot of funny conversations. You know, in terms of, you know, life here in this city, what are some of the common things you hear people talking about? What are their gripes with the city? What are their gripes with politics? What do you hear people talking about?
I talked the other day with somebody that has a sushi business. He said when he first, you know, he asked me how business was. I asked him how business was. And we both said that it was not so good. And he wanted to know if I thought it was the season or if it was the economy. And I said, well, I think it's the season for the taxi company. And he said, well, have you noticed how many mom and pop companies businesses are disappearing one by one? And I said, yeah, I have. And he said, well, you know, when he first came to this country, he's, I guess, Japanese anyway, he bought the New York Times and he read it like all the way through every day. And today when he buys the New York Times, he said, I can't find myself in there.
That was Monocle's correspondent in New York City. Before that, we heard from Madrid, and before that, Ramallah. They were gauging the popular mood, just like the Norwegian Prime Minister before them, from a taxi cab. You're listening to Monocle 24.
Now, Dom, London taxi drivers are notorious for being quite chatty, aren't they?
They are quite chatty. I have to say, I'm not one for cab chat. This is terrible to admit as a journalist. Unless I'm on a story, I don't do much cab chat.
You can learn quite a bit from a taxi driver, I found.
You certainly can. What have you learned?
You know, when I first came to the city, you know, 4 years ago, I didn't know much about kind of the ins and outs and all the weird kind of
cultural
things.
Yeah, you aren't the metropolitan creature that you are today.
Yeah, so now I know all the great fish and chips places to go.
Did he teach you your great British accent that you do?
It's quite good, isn't it? Well, in the next half hour, we'll leave it there. I'll stick to my normal accent.
I'll kick you out of a cab for that, I think.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll talk with our man in Budapest. We'll be flicking through the Turkish front pages and we'll meet the woman behind that country's first design biennale.
With the Design Biennial now, we are creating a new platform where we have the opportunity to come together and discuss and see and experience and show to other people or to exchange about all design fields.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
At least 16 people have been killed and 41 injured in a suicide bomb attack on a crowded cafe in Balad, 80 kilometres north of Baghdad. The mayor of Balad says all the casualties were civilians. US Secretary of State John Kerry says Israel's announcement of new settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem was to some degree expected, but he urged Israelis and Palestinians to go ahead with peace talks due to resume this week. Officials in Israel say the military has intercepted a rocket near Egypt's Sinai Peninsula, exploding it in the air over the southern Israeli city of Eilat. No damage or injury was reported in the incident, which was the first time Israel's Iron Dome interceptor had struck a missile fired at Eilat. A court in the United States has found a brutal gangster who ruled over Boston's criminal underworld in the 1970s and 80s guilty of murder and racketeering. 83-year-old James Whitey Bulger evaded capture for 16 years, but is now likely to spend the rest of his life in prison. A US judge has ruled that the New York Police Department's stop-and-frisk crime-fighting tactic was unconstitutional. The judge called it indirect racial profiling because it targeted racially defined groups. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg says he'll be appealing against the ruling. A man has died after falling some 60 feet from the upper deck of the Atlanta Braves' Turner Field baseball stadium. The Braves issued a statement during their game against the Philadelphia Phillies, confirming the fall. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Barney. You're back with the Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. Now, over the last two very special editions of Section D, the team has documented a city that reflects some of the change evident in modern Turkey. It is a city in the midst of flux and a space where design in all its forms is growing and gaining recognition. While celebrating some of this excitement is the Istanbul Foundation for Culture and Arts, who in 2012 launched the city's first design biennale.
In light of the changes taking place in the city, the incumbent in charge of the show, Ali John, was eager to find out what next year's design biennale would have in store. He met with the new director of the event, Denise Olva, in her Shoshane office.
I think in the last 10 or 15 years, we had an upcoming scene or a vibrating scene. I mean, design was always important, I think, for Turkey and especially for Istanbul, but we may not have found the right way to show it or to talk about it, to discuss about design. And I think with the Design Biennial now, we're creating a new platform where we have the opportunity to come together and discuss and see and experience and show to other people or to exchange about all design fields.
So what is the aim then? To promote Turkish designers or to raise awareness?
To raise awareness. Promotion is not the aim. Of course, we like to work with Turkish designers. We like to find out more about them, to find new designers and see how they're working. But the biennial is not a fair, is not a commercial event to show or expose Turkish designers. It's just a new platform where we work with a curator, come up with a theme, a conceptual framework, and work in the design field around this conceptual framework. And design is not only product design, design is everything for us. It's architecture, urban design, it's graphic design, fashion design, social design, new media, everything that can be related with design, and then to see how do they work with each other or how do they interact, do they interact even, or are they just separate fields? That's one approach to the Design Biennial. If it comes to promotion, you always have labels like designed in Turkey or Turkish design, good design, products. It's all about products, but products are, or the end products are not the only thing in the context of design. There is a way of process, there is a way of coming up with ideas and thinking and working with design, or what does design do to the people, or how do people affect design. There's a whole world around it, and I think if you say promotion, it's only the promotion of an end product, either it's good or bad, whatever, but it's more in design.
I've spoken to quite a few designers and architects and urban planners, of course, for the two shows that we're doing on Istanbul. Some of the designers seem to think there's probably somewhere between 50 and 100 actual designers in Turkey. Is it maybe a bit too early for a design biennale, or do you think now is the time to drive up awareness of a kind of nascent community?
I think it was just a time. Maybe we could have done it also earlier to maybe have another approach to design, but I would say it's just the time, because the people were just creating awareness about design, but maybe it was going in a direction that wasn't really talking to us, so we had the urge to come up with a different field or different platform where we can discuss design. And I cannot say any numbers about designers, because I'm sure there are more designers than we know, than we can reach out to, but it's just the right time, and the environment is just talking about design so much.
How are you going to be able to distinguish between art and design? Obviously, the boundaries blur quite a lot, and there's a lot of designers in Istanbul especially have their work sometimes showcased in art galleries. How can the Design Biennale 2014 distinguish between these two things?
Well, good question. The content is a different one. If you've been visiting art biennials, I mean, the pattern, let's say, the structure might be in one way or the other the same. We're talking about an exhibition, we're talking about discussion platforms, we're talking about workshops, masterclasses, whatever, but the content is a different one. Maybe we can say design is closer to the public, because people work with design, they have design in their life. I mean, people have arts in their life, but design is not really always seen as a design. It's something you use, it's just there, yeah. And art is something you have to approach to, or even if it's there, you might not be aware of it in that way that it is talking to you. I think content-wise, there's a clear differentiation. But one other thing is, of course, how does design and art talk to each other? That's another field that might be interesting to talk about and to explore. Till now, it was going in two sideways, let's say. And then now maybe we're meeting, we're not. That's the whole issue right now, I think.
You've appointed Zoe Ryan. First of all, can we discuss what you would like to see from Zoe Ryan? And then afterwards, I'd like to try and get a feel for what you will be approaching in terms of subject matter in the Design Biennale in 2014. So first, Zoe.
I think we can see everything. The field is so open, and working with each time with a new curator gives us new opportunities and new ways to explore design. I think what we will see with Zoe is she might call it as bringing design back. Since the last biennial was in a direction more showing architecture, urban design, also focusing on product design, but there were some design fields that weren't, I don't want to say missing, but lightly shown, like graphic design or fashion design. So it might be that we're more going in the design direction with the next biennial. And Zoe, I think she's just such an open person that will be able to show everything. In her work, she has done different design shows. So she's been working on different design fields specifically and not only going in one way. So I think she's a good choice to show a little bit more, to go deeper into the scene, to see more about design, what about design and what is design.
Looking at Istanbul then at the moment, in terms of approaching 2014, it's still a while away. It's a very interesting moment at the moment across the fields that you mentioned there, so architecture, urban planning, design. Do you foresee that you'll be reflecting some of the social issues that we see in the streets of Istanbul?
Well, I cannot say actually. I mean, it's obviously an exciting moment. There is a change. There is a lot in the air. But as you said, we're talking about October to December 2014. So I'm sure it will be in one way or the other touching all these issues that are going on right now. But I cannot tell for sure that there will be something. And at the end, I mean, the creator, Zoe, she'll be working on a conceptual framework and coming up with a theme. And if there are designers or projects working with that theme, then it's there. But if it's not talking to this issue, the designers or the project that are selected, that might not be in the exhibition. But I'm sure since this is a burning issue and the design scene was talking about it for more than 1 year now, more than 5 years, let's say, this change is going on for a while, but there is an outburst right now.
And that was the new director of the 2014 Design Biennale, Denisova, speaking to Alijan in the final report for our Turkey editions of Section D, which airs at 2100 hours Istanbul time, 1900 hours if you're in London, and 1400 hours in New York City.
That is comprehensive. You are listening to Midori House. We're going to be back right after this with our man in Budapest. Stay with us.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
From Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dana.
From Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House, where the time here in London is 8:43.
Now, that means it is time to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, that is going to be Adam Labor. He's our man in Budapest, of course, and he joins us now. Adam, welcome back to Midori House. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine, thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, good to have you back. And we will start with Hungary having repaid its IMF loan early. Clearly, whoever's in charge of that is going to be in for some political gains, no?
Absolutely, yes. Hungary's repaid its debt about 2.15 billion euros. It's supposed to be going in the third quarter of 2014. And now it's gone in almost a year early. So it's definitely going to bring political kudos for the right-wing government under Prime Minister Viktor Orban, because he's gone in very hard against what he calls the IMF and foreign, sort of portraying this picture of Hungary being besieged by foreign forces such as the IMF and multinationals and international banks, which is all kind of rather odd, really, because without foreign investment, the Hungarian economy would be in far worse shape than it is now.
And we also know, Adam, that earlier in the year, the IMF closed their office in Hungary. How much of an actual issue has this been in the run-up to next year's election? Is this an issue that are on the minds of Hungarians?
It is, actually, yeah, because the government here is extremely strong. It has a two-thirds majority. And much of the state television, for example, is being criticized as being very pro-government, almost kind of pumping out government propaganda. And the government's putting out this message, as I said before, really, this slightly odd message that this, you know, Hungary is a small, proud country being besieged by the nasty forces of international capitalism. And this is playing very well. I mean, there is an element in this of truth. I mean, if you look at what's happening in Greece, for example, and other countries with parlous economies, you know, you see the people from the Troika, the European Central Bank, and the EU and the IMF flying in and telling governments what to do. And understandably, people don't like it. But Hungary is not really in a crisis like that, where they're, you know, giving directions to the government. They just had a loan from the IMF, which helped the country out, helped it avoid going bankrupt. And now the IMF is being portrayed as some kind of evil force. And this is playing very well. So there's definite political kudos for the government in this being repaid back early.
I wonder what exactly, perhaps there are lessons for those other governments struggling with much more serious financial problems, but Hungary has nevertheless done a pretty good job of getting itself back into the black quite quickly. What sort of policies were pursued that allowed this to happen?
There's all sorts of policies. I mean, the government's policies have been quite heavily criticised. They've done things such as imposing a crisis tax on various sectors such as retail and telecommunications, which came as a big surprise because a lot of those sectors are owned by foreign investors. They've also imposed a bank tax. Now, nobody likes banks, and so the bank tax has proved very popular. But the problem with bank taxes is that they just generally tend to get passed on down to the consumer. You know, bank charges go up, so no one's really benefiting. And also lending is pulled back because the banks have less profits. So, I mean, there are, you know, complicated questions here about how you juggle a country's national economy. But many people feel that kind of going to war, you know, a verbal war against the IMF and the banks, instead of engaging with them more productively, is not necessarily the best way forward, because there's lots of, you know, foreign investors are put off by the erraticness of these policies. Some of them are backdated. So it all makes for an atmosphere of uncertainty. And Hungary, you know, less people live in Hungary than in London, and it desperately needs foreign investment.
And Adam, we had you on this program a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about the Sziget Festival and some of the performers which were going to be appearing. But it looks like the festival is not financially, at least, going to have a very good year.
No, it's announced a loss of between 100 and 200 million forints. So 220 million forints is $1 million. So it's quite a substantial loss, even though a lot of people turned up. I mean, the numbers weren't hardly down. They were still around 370,000, 360,000. But people seem to be paying less and spending less. I guess that's, you know, a general symptom of the recession in Europe. And it's noticeable that there weren't such great headline bands this year. I mean, the biggest name I could see on the program was Blur, who are very big. But I mean, even Blur, they're a bit sort of kind of 1990s-ish. I mean, they're not the most up-to-date band. And, you know, the really big names don't seem to have come. I mean, there's great kind of like world music and regional music. I mean, you can still have a very good time there, but they're not pulling in the headliners, as the organizer, Peter Gerendash, said. So, and that seems to have affected the amount of profit that they're turning.
Well, Adam, we're going to have to unfortunately leave it there. Adam Labor, our correspondent in Budapest, there with a wrap of some of the stories making the headlines over there in Hungary.
We have the Turkish newspapers coming up in a few moments' time. And to get us in the mood for that, here's Murat Dalkılıç with Yürüm Yürüm. That was Murat Dalkilic with Yudum Yudum. And Yudum Yudum means what exactly, Alex de Kramer?
Drop by drop.
There we go, live translation.
Alex, thanks for joining us here in the studio. Alex de Kramer is our Turkish resident Turk, I guess you could say. And you've got some of the Turkish front pages as well. Are you a fan of Yudum Yudum? I feel like we need to be at some nightclub in Istanbul or something.
Yeah, definitely. It's a bit too much for in the morning.
Yeah, it's a bit early for us. Yeah.
I need to wake up.
Pumping tunes at 8:52.
Wow. Get us in the mood. We were hearing a bit earlier in the program, Section D, which of course is our design program with Alijan, will be airing later this evening at 1900 hours London time. But it's part two in a very special series on kind of Istanbul and Turkey and kind of relationships between the historical past and modernization. What are your kind of views on that situation?
About how it's become more modern.
Well, this clash between kind of the new and trying to preserve the old. And, you know, of course,
we don't preserve the old, unfortunately. Listen to Aladdin, you'll see more in detail. That's the main problem. That's what Gezi Park is all about. That's what we're one of the countries that has the most malls yet again. That modernization idea, it's more about mall building than rather like nice architectural buildings and kind of incorporating the old and new.
And you've got, I guess, the perfect story to really highlight that rush to modernize.
So it's just headlines today is that, again, our prime minister type, Erdogan, this time in Ankara, not in Istanbul, is cutting. So the headline reads, cutting trees at night and making roads in the daytime. Basically, so there is a bid for the presidential palace that was up since May 2012. And we all thought that that was kind of not happening due to the recent events. But obviously, we were mistaken. He would like to build an 8-story, 8 floors, 10 buildings, like a huge complex, a new presidency palace.
Wow. Is there going to be a shopping mall as well in there?
Yeah.
Maybe a gift shop. Totally.
It's the one building project that doesn't involve a mall.
It will have a helipad, yeah.
Good.
Probably, maybe. And the problem is it's built, so now it's in Çankaya. It's called the Köşke. It's in Çankaya where he's living, and it's kind of in the middle of the city. Now, this is next to the Atatürk Forestry Farm. And it's been said that already 10,000 trees have been demolished. So happy. There's actually an aerial picture. So you can see last year, it's a really tiny one. So you can see basically there's an aerial picture of last year.
Yes.
Putting
sort of satellite picture looks a bit bit empty. And then on the right hand side, there's definitely some building activity having gone on.
You can see a huge U being digged out.
I mean, I wonder, given that there are some question marks over exactly what the role and the scope of the presidency in Turkey should be at the moment, isn't it a bit controversial that that this project's going ahead?
It is. Actually, off of that, this columnist, Cüneyt Özdemir from Radikal, was mentioning that. So it's still debated whether or not we're going to have a presidency. But already the palace is on its way. So he's basically stating that the decision has already been done. We have no say, although we're debating about it. We have a residency for the president. So
the thing that kind of shocked me is this palace is going to be 8 floors, 10 buildings, 150,000 square meters. It's got a helipad, but it's only going to cost $3 million. That's
probably not
that much.
Probably not. I think that was in the initial bid. We haven't heard anything about how much it's going to cost. That was one of the figures that I was able to find, but they haven't started. So this is just like they have to first have an area to build it. So this is kind of getting to it. So and it's said that they're going to have an 8-lane road,
wow,
12 kilometers. That's opening 2004. That's actually in that will go to the presidential palace. So
kind
of reminds me of Saudi Arabia,
lanes.
You know, from
it's going to need 8 lanes for the motorcade that will go with it. Let's move on to a second story, which is about what you are or are not allowed to wear in Parliament.
Yeah. So actually, this story is from Cumhuriyet, the Republic newspaper, which is a bit leftish. So basically yesterday, the CHP and BDP together, they had issued a bill for equality, so that ethnically your sexual orientation should and your gender should not be discriminated in Parliament. Of course, this was reflected, only one part of this three-part bill was accepted, which is basically women should not be discriminated in the Parliament in any way, which people are saying it has given a green light for women to wear
Well, it sounds like
turbans.
Quite a landmark bill, I guess, for Parliament.
It depends on whether or not parliament members will be actually wearing turbans because no one has been elected that wears a turban at the moment, but certainly it will be allowed by law. So it's a controversial issue because it's been on the topic of AK Party since 2002.
Okay, let's briefly move on to a third story then. This is from The Radical.
Mm-hmm. So this is yesterday, a town called Raqqa in Syria, which is 90 kilometers from Turkey's Akçakale, which was also bombed by mistake, if you remember, a couple of months ago. Around 3,000 to 4,000 people flocked to Turkey. And I just think it's really interesting because what's been happening with Gezi Park and stuff, we have forgotten that one of the biggest issues on Turkey's agenda is the Syrian refugees. They're almost, since now July, we have around 2 million Syrian refugees. And so the Turkey, in collaboration with the EU actually, has started building compounds. One of them is from in my hometown, Izmir. And people actually protested because they don't want Syrians coming into their cities because it kind of will affect the entire, how the city works. So, regardless, it hasn't been discussed in the city, but it's happening in Izmir. They're going to have around a compound for 2,000 Syrians.
Excellent. Alex, thanks very much for bringing in the Soju, the Cumhuriyet and the Radical newspapers from this morning's front pages. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thank you very much to our producer, Mr. Danny Giacopelli. The show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and by Ilya Simos. And our studio manager today was Chris Fitch. The Entrepreneurs is up next after the news.
Dom and I will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds.
Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.